This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Digital Humanities, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Katie McDonough, one of the hosts of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ruth Onnert, Sebastian Onnert, Nicole Coleman, and Scott Weingart. Ruth, Sebastian, Nicole, and Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I think starting with Ruth, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks for having us. So my title is a Professor of Literary History and Digital Humanities at Queen Mary, University of London. And my background is actually in English literature with a focus on Tudor culture and history. And my first book was on something that seems quite unrelated to this, which is Tudor prison literature. But I've actually been increasingly collaborating with people who you might call data scientists, starting firstly with Sebastian. But now I work on a massive project with 23 people that include data scientists, curators and library professionals and historians. So that's a little bit about my journey.
Great, thanks. And turning over to Sebastian.
Hi, yeah. So my background is in physics originally, but now I work more on the interface between physics and biology. But as part of my research, I've for a long time been interested in complex networks, which is a field that emerged in its modern incarnation out of statistical physics. And it is concerned with the analysis of networks of all kinds using mathematical tools. And it is a very interdisciplinary field, and that's what brought me to collaborate with Ruth on historical networks. So increasingly over the last, I would say, 8 years or so, I've been more and more involved in digital humanities as well as a result of that research.
Great, thank you. And Nicole?
Thanks, Katie, for having us today. So currently my title is Digital Research Architect in the Stanford Libraries, but I've been working, I would say, in digital humanities primarily, certainly for most of my career at Stanford, and really came to that through an interest in the arts, design, and intersection with the humanities. And then, of course, how we can bring technology into that. So I am, unlike the other members of this group, very much sort of on the outside of the academy in many ways, though I work within it. I suppose if we were doing a network graph, all of us, we'd have to be careful about how we define those lines of connection to be able to include me in it. But I'm glad to be here.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. And Scott?
Thank you, Katie. So I am Scott Weingart. I direct the Naveri Family Center for Digital Scholarship at the University of Notre Dame, which is a position I have held for the last few months. I'm quite new here. My background is in history of science. Like I think all of my colleagues here have worked on early modern correspondence and collaboration networks. I also spent some time in an information science lab looking at contemporary scientific networks.
Excellent. Thank you. And I think now we're going to turn to the book itself, which is The Network Turn, Changing Perspectives in the Humanities. It was published last year, at the very end of the year, by Cambridge in the New Elements series. And this is in the Elements in Publishing and Book Culture part of that series. So we're just going to walk through the different parts of the book, starting with the introduction. And Nicole, I think you're going to tell us a little bit about the introduction of The Network Turn.
Yes, I'd be glad to. So in the introduction, we really lay out not just the intentions of the book itself, but something about the intentions of this collaboration and you know the way that we ourselves are coming at this question about the network turn from different perspectives. But we really wanted to invite people into the conversation with this text. This text is, it's very, very brief. I'm really quite proud of the brevity of it, the amount that we've been able to fit into such a small text. But it's meant to be an opening, the opening of a conversation. And we begin this with, by sort of juxtaposing Mark Lombardi and his visualization of networks and Barabasi and this sort of advance of this notion of scale-free networks happening, you know, almost about the same time. And while we don't have any evidence that there was any kind of conversation between them, what we try to do across the book is to bring these sort of the, you know, two cultures into conversation and, you know, hopefully let the humanities kind of be, you know, a space to be able to bring the arts and the sciences together into that conversation.
Thanks. And I guess a natural follow-up to that, and also to sort of explain how you guys ended up working on this book together is how did this project come together? And in the introduction, you mentioned that the interface between, as you write, computational method, humanistic inquiry, and design practice are really central to taking work in network analysis further in the future. So what did that mean for each of you?
Shall I jump in there?
Sure.
Well, I was going to say that my work in this area very much started in the home because I'm married to Sebastian and he was working in network science and I was reading more and more about what he was doing. And I was like, hey, I've got networks. I've got all these letters. Could we do something with this? And so it started out as that conversation over a kitchen table, and eventually we tried some work together, and then we did a project together, and then we ended up in Stanford on a fellowship, and then we met Nicole, and we started talking a lot over cocktails, and we had just had such rich conversations with her that we were saying one night we should write a text about this, and not just about the kind of outcome of the research, but a kind of framework for these kind of discussions. And then I think I'll hand over to Nicole here, but then we can talk about how Scott came into the picture as well.
Yeah, and let me give a little bit more of that sort of background too, to what sort of set the stage for Ruth's and Sebastian's visit to Stanford. You know, I was very fortunate to be a part of Mapping Republic of Letters project. And it was really due to the generosity there, you know, at Stanford, of scholars like Paula Finland and Dan Edelstein, Richard White, Zephyr Frank, Giovanna Cesarani, really starting conversations about digital humanities. And while that began with spatial history, really, with Mapping Republic of Letters, that's where we really moved into this notion of networks. And it wasn't long after that that we went from networks to this notion of what became Humanities Plus Design Research Lab, where we were thinking about this, using networks as a way of externalizing thought as part of the necessity for communicating across disciplines. And at the same time, there were a number of other projects going on looking at networks, particularly in the early modern period. We began collaborating with Charles Vandenhoevel and also, you know, Howard Hudson and his team at Oxford, and of course with Scott Weingart and Katie Borner in Indiana. Scott, do you want to pick up there?
Yeah, so I, you know, Nicole, earlier you said that you're perhaps a little bit aside of the career paths of your colleagues here. But you know what? I would say that you're probably at the very center of our collaboration network. So I started this work on early modern correspondence networks, working as a research assistant as an undergraduate for Bob Hatch at the University of Florida, and was just making these vast Excel spreadsheets of correspondence in the early modern world. I did not know anything about network analysis. I did not know that it was a thing that happened. I happened to be working on a project that was doing network analysis. I just didn't realize it at the time. And then I want to say it was 2009 or 2010, I found Katie Borner, and then shortly thereafter, Nicole Coleman, and started collaborating with her and others on these larger scale network analysis of early modern Europe projects. And then through that, of course, eventually met Ruth and Seb, which is, I think, how we all found ourselves in this situation. And Seb, I'll let you finish it off.
Well, I think, Ruth already mentioned sort of how I got into this. Really, it was our collaboration. Actually, I think it was as early as 2008 that, because I was in Barabasi's lab for 6 months, and already then, I think Ruth had already started becoming interested in the idea of networks in her prison book. But I think where we all first met, all four of us, was actually the conference that was organized at Stanford towards the end of our stay. And I think that's maybe where we first all started talking about this book collectively. But as has been apparent from the what people have said, I think this network has been sort of was formed over several years and gradually. So I think it's another interesting, we talk a bit in the book about networks over time, and I think inherently all social networks are temporal, and you can see them sort of growing in our data, and it's nice to think about it sort of how our network grew over time as well. So but I would say yes, I think it all this book really started near the end of our Stanford stay, and I think the Stanford fellowship and was actually quite instrumental in bringing us all together in that respect.
Thank you so much. It's such a great story to hear how people come together to do research, not only so that other people can learn about those models, but also to think about sort of how that changes over time. Great. So I think now we're going to dive into the first couple of chapters, and Scott is going to start us off there.
Sure. So, excuse me. The first section of the book, part one, is what we call it on frameworks, which contains two chapters on networks as a sort of framework of thinking. Chapter one, we titled Networks Are Always Metaphorical, and it really begins by anchoring networks as a linguistic and a methodological framework that furnishes scholarly thinking. We trace the concept from this grid-like lattice in the 16th century through sociometry of Helen Hall Jennings and Jacob Moreno and folks like that, and then to its popularity today. We argue that those who employ networks as either methodological tools or conceptual metaphors ought to know about the other sometimes opposing usage because of how squarely each relies on the other. We also point out that because network science so often crosses disciplinary boundaries, often foundational concepts get neglected as somebody else's problem. So we're really hoping to start addressing them here. And we don't really dive into it as we said earlier, this is a slim volume and intended more as a provocation, but we're pointing out that often these concepts do get neglected. Chapter 2 on historical threads answers the question of why arts and humanities scholars ought to attend to networks. And we say that it's not really a matter of whether or not it's important, but that it's honestly unavoidable in the world that we live in. Networks mediate our lives, and we are as stuck inside them as everyone else is, so we better be paying attention to them. In this chapter, we kind of go through a whirlwind tour of mostly European and Anglophone history to show how networks, as a metaphor, as a visual mode of thinking, and as a disciplinary lens, shape how we think, and vice versa. Specifically, we look at the visual affordances of networks. Are they bounded or unbounded, centered or hierarchical, and so on? And then show how these rhetorical notes turn out to be intrinsically linked to the more philosophical perspectives that surround them. Then we conclude this chapter and the section by emphasizing the inherent sociopolitical nature of networks, which then lays the groundwork for subsequent chapters.
Thanks. That's a really excellent summary. And there's so much rich material in here that can lead to rich discussion. I just have a couple of questions to dig in a little bit. I'm really interested in these statements about, you know, the first chapter, you talk about networks as being inherently domain crossing and what gets lost in a sense, between disciplines, who might be working with data versus the people who are generating data. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit more, maybe provide an example of, you know, what happens when you start to pay attention to that.
Sure. So one example is the fact that we often don't think about the proxies that we are using to create networks. That is, what is a node? What is an edge? And how does it relate to the network theory in which we are currently acting? And one of the reasons for this, partially it's because everything is cross-disciplinary, and partially it's an issue with every discipline, which is just we've inherited a series of methodologies and frameworks. These frameworks were really carefully, theoretically constructed 50 years ago, 70 years ago. It's sort of hard to constantly think about that at the same time that we're thinking about all of the work that we're doing now. What can happen, unfortunately, sometimes, is that we're defining certain things as nodes or edges. We've been talking about correspondence networks, so we'll say people and letters between them as a network. And then we put it into our network analysis toolkits and run the various algorithms that we run on them, being, you know, PageRank or centrality or whatever else, without thinking too critically about the theoretical underpinnings of what centrality means, what PageRank does. That can wind up getting us in trouble when we are using data that operates under certain assumptions that the algorithms don't abide by. For example, I don't want to get too technical here. Let me think of a good example. If we're talking about centrality, if we're talking about something like betweenness centrality on a network, which is how many somebody sits, somebody is very betweenness central if they sit between many other nodes on a network. And if we're dealing with a very incomplete network, that betweenness centrality can sort of bias the people that we remember, the people that history has recorded in ways that can occlude other voices, for example.
Yeah, I think all of this is just really rich, fodder for continuing to think about, especially as more people undertake network analysis. And I love that you open this chapter with a question, the second chapter, Historical Threads, which says, but why would scholars from the arts and humanities bother themselves with the task of theorizing and operating within the network turn that you guys are describing in the book? And I think that the approach to providing a history of that engagement with thinking about how we organize knowledge, the relationship between the knowledge, as you say, what we see and what we know across time, is a really powerful demonstration of how humanities scholars have been engaged with these theories for centuries. In the quote, there's a quote that you use from Lorraine Daston's work, where you talk about what the quote is, perception furnishes the universe. It doesn't create the universe, but it does shape and sort, outlining sharp edges and arranging parts into wholes. And because you do talk about sort of the relationship of part to whole several times across the book, I wondered if anyone wanted to say something, even briefly, about this issue of what these first two chapters really grapple with, of the relationship between sort of something real in the world and the abstraction of the network, and how that is a useful distinction in research is productive.
Seb, you always say really nice things about abstraction.
Yes, I was just going to say, it's really what actually chapter five is about to quite a large degree, which is that abstraction is often importance of abstraction falls a bit by the wayside in actually in both the humanities and the sciences separately in some sense, because I think the humanities don't always realize aren't that used to having to abstract, because the humanities tend to study the detail and to sort of relish in exploring the detail and describing it and looking at a case study. And the sciences, on the other hand, are too used to abstraction in that they, a scientist is excited if they get a data set to play with, and they don't really think or don't even have the information to think about how the real world was abstracted in the first place to arrive at that data set, unless they've, of course, conducted an experiment themselves. But more often than not in data science, you sort of get a data set from somewhere and start playing with it, and you don't know really how well that relates to the real world. So I think it was really important for us, I think, to think about this in the book, if you're a humanities scholar who wants to do quantitative research, you really have to take your historical research problem or your literary research problem and throw away information, which is probably a very painful process, but it's also a very important part of being able to use quantitative methods, because the data in all its original complexity is really not is not ready for quantitative analysis. You have to make choices. Such, for instance, you have to choose what you regard as your nodes and your edges. How do you define an individual in the network? And that might not even be as straightforward as being a single person. It might be a single identity, which might be split between people, for instance. Or there might be a person who has multiple identities as well. So, and then of course you also get into the problems of disambiguation and data cleaning. But on another note, it's maybe more straightforward example of abstraction is how to treat a connection between two people. You can have an unweighted, undirected network just of a binary network of social contact. Did these people know each other, were they in contact with each other or not? And that's the simplest form of data, and it allows you to analyze, or for this kind of data, there are the most, the greatest number of tools available. But if you start adding complexities, such as a direction to a network edge, if you take into account, you know, which way was correspondence flowing, you have a richer data set, but you also have fewer tools at your disposal because the complexity of the analysis increases. And you could take into account how many letters passed between two people. That would add another level of complexity. And the most complex correspondence network is the full temporal data set, where you take into account the timing of every edge. And that's incredibly rich, but it also is very hard to actually analyze quantitatively, because you have to redefine your network metrics in a way that makes sense in a sort of constantly evolving network. But at the same time, it also allows you to ask richer questions. So I think we... So this process of abstraction happens on a continuum, and it's actually important to choose where you locate yourself in that continuum when you answer a particular research question. And it might make sense to choose more abstraction or less abstraction depending on what questions you want to answer.
Thank you. And I think Scott has some additional thoughts there, and Ruth as well.
So yes, I think that in addition to what Seb is saying, one of the real advantages of networks specifically is they operate at many different scales, from the micro to the meso to the macro. And so if, as Seb was saying, in the sciences, we often focus on the tendency to generalize or to abstract, and in the humanities, we focus on the tendency to specify, to find the particularities, both of those are encompassable within a network paradigm. And so networks really do act as a very useful and strong bridge, or at least they can, between the sciences and the humanities, which is one of the provocations that we make in this book.
Great, thank you. And Ruth, some final comments on that?
I think I was going to say something quite similar about, you know, this idea that you have to throw information away. You're not throwing it away permanently. You're making a decision in that moment when to throw something away, to get to a conclusion, to get to an idea. And you can move back and forth along that landscape of abstraction, adding more information or moving into more abstract realms, depending on what your question is. So it's not a kind of, you're making one decision, you're throwing things away. You're kind of able to move effortlessly between these spaces. And I think network analysis gives you the ability to move between those scales of analysis in a really nice way.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my own research and the research that we're doing and living with machines, this is one of the real promises, and it's really exciting. And we're not doing that explicitly in network analysis, but I think it's something that we've learned from an awareness of that kind of environment in which you can move across scales. Sebastian.
Yes, just I had another thought related to that, which we also touched on in, I think, chapter 3, which is that network analysis can also be applied where you might not suspect it, which is not in the context of, say, correspondence networks or social networks, but in networks of association between entities. So between, for instance, people and places, or objects and people, or texts and miscellanies, or so any kind of set, if you have two or more entities and they are connected by associations, you can construct a network, and that allows you to apply network analysis in contexts where it maybe wasn't sort of obvious, and that in turn is another form of abstraction. So it's another way of taking relationships between entities and turning them into something that you can analyze with an algorithm, and then examine again through the lens of your humanities discipline.
Well, and I think we've already said a lot now. We've borrowed a lot from chapter 3, but Ruth, is there anything else that you'd like to say to kind of talk about where the book goes after the kind of historical setup of networks that Scott described?
Okay, so chapter 3 is kind of an overview of all of the things that you can do with a network approach to culture. It's really a whistle-stop tour showing how the framework can be used to, say, look at the interactions of characters in Shakespeare's plays, to think about the dissemination of memes on Facebook, or even the trade network implicated in the ancient Roman brick industry. So it can cover very diverse circumstances. But what I'm really proud of in this chapter is how it grapples with the idea of the problems of thinking about quantitative approaches as giving us objective tools to look at culture. Instead, we sort of push on the idea that the underlying data is actually subject to all kinds of shaping forces, that the creation of data sets require decisions and interpretations that introduce subjectivity into the process. It talks about the duty of care around data cleaning and our need to heed what is absent and where biases have affected the shape of our data.
Thank you. Yes, and I really like the way that you guys draw on Daniel Rosenberg's formulation quote, facts are ontological, evidence is epistemological, and data is rhetorical, and use that as a kind of entree into talking about absence and bias in data and the ways that, you know, scholars in different disciplines can as you say, really attend to these problems, not simply as problems, but also as opportunities for understanding the information that they have at their disposal. And I wanted to kind of pose as a question to any of you, a proposition that you make in this chapter, which is, you know, that incompleteness doesn't have to be a disaster. And that this is something that incompleteness is something that we share across the disciplines. And so what are ways that we can have interdisciplinary approaches to dealing with incompleteness?
Yeah, maybe I can say something. So I think I just wrote a paper on incompleteness with someone on our Networking Archives project, which is another project that Ruth and I are involved in with Jan Ryan. And actually, in the humanities, there's often, I think, a big concern about incompleteness and the fact that you can't draw conclusions necessarily from incomplete data using quantitative approaches. And I think what's maybe underestimated is that in the sciences, you're largely dealing with incomplete data all the time, and that also network analysis in particular. Almost every real-world network data set that I've ever come across is incomplete in the sense that it doesn't reflect, you know, the true network of social interactions. And even, say, within a mobile phone network, you'll still only capture, a fraction of the actual mobile phone connections in that community, because you will only have the data from one operator, etc. So incompleteness is pervasive. And you just have to be careful when you draw conclusions from your quantitative results that they aren't crucially affected by that incompleteness. But there will be many research questions that you can still answer, at least to some degree, in light of that incompleteness, because it simply won't affect those questions. So I think that's so incompleteness is inevitable, and it's part of, I think, any. Almost part of data science, I think, and related approaches. And you just have to be conscious of its presence and try to mitigate its effect on your research questions. What we also did in that research paper I mentioned is to look at, we actually simulated, we removed portions of network data and looked at how the network metrics change. And the good news, in a sense, is that you can actually, certain types of network analysis are remarkably unaffected by removal of data. And that's because a lot of networks are highly skewed in the way that node characteristics and ed characteristics are distributed. So, the top players will still be the top players, even if you remove 50% or more of the data because of the skewedness. And so certain quantitative outcomes are remarkably unaffected, but again, some are affected, and you just have to be aware of that, or you have to perform tests that bring that to the fore.
I think Sebastian is more influenced by his domestic partnership than maybe he realizes in this response to incompleteness. I would have to say that that there's a tremendous awareness of incompleteness, you know, uncertainty in data, and just starting with uncertainty within the humanities as a given. And so ways of figuring out, you know, how to address that uncertainty very much about, you know, repositioning, right? Or, you know, kind of looking at things from multiple different facets. And I think there's actually more influence already in the sciences than are, you know, fully accounted for. But you mentioned Rosenberg and this way of helping us to think about data by looking at the history of data and how it helps us to see what are the sort of, you know, disciplinary assumptions around what we mean when we talk about data. And so if you put that next to Drucker, where we bring up this point that she's made that we really should be talking about CAPTA, not data, because, you know, data is what is given. CAPTA is something that we take. So there's an inherent choice around that, and putting the emphasis on the choices that we're making. When we get to the point of, you know, let's say as Sebastian, you know, mentioned, sort of generalizing, yes, there's still conclusions we can draw, but let's point our attention back to the fact that those were editorial decisions made from the beginning in terms of, you know, what are the bounds of that data set? And then from that point of what are the bounds of the data set, then what do we choose to look at within it? So I think there's more to be discovered through our own collaboration. It'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, I think that's right. And yeah, there's a lot of wonderful writing in the chapter that digs into Joanna Drucker's work on thinking about CAPTA and these other formulations of, you know, the history of data, of what we now call data, and the possibilities that we have for thinking about, you know, what cleaning does, what data curation really does to a data set, and the interpretive choices that are built into that very important work. Okay, great. Right. So, Nicole, do you want to take us on to a summary of chapter 4, visual networks?
Absolutely. So I think the very fact that we have a chapter titled visual networks is because very often, particularly people who are not doing network science, often first think of networks as visual because it's we see them. It's this imaginary that we have around, you know, what is a network. It's a very much a visual concept. But in fact, I think that making networks visual, the way that we opened this book with Lombardi and Barbasi, who also used visualization significantly in its own research. Visualizing networks has sort of become, I guess one, you know, could say sort of a fulcrum for this navigating and communicating across disciplines. At least I hope that's the case. We really sort of start by talking about Jacques Bertin and the semiology of graphics and this sort of notion of formalizing a language. And you know, in that text, he's covering, you know, lots of visual forms and networks just being one of them. But it's quite interesting to take into account what his thinking was and his assumptions and even sort of excitement about where computation, the formalization of computation, would then be able to take visualization and visualization of networks in particular. And again, we can put that, you know, contrast that with Drucker, putting our trying to bring our emphasis back or our thinking back to a focus on what is encoded in visualization, the assumptions that come with visualization, particularly visualizations that are computationally produced that have this kind of the visual rhetoric suggests some kind of precision, right? That isn't necessarily there. And, you know, Drucker particularly says, as we capture in this chapter, that you know, what you're seeing in a visualization is not what is, right? But it is an argument. So, you know, bringing us back by that to that, I think also in the course of our putting this book together, where we've come since the beginning of our work together, the all of the authors in our own lives, data has become so much more personal. So our relationship to it is different. It's affecting all of us from day to day. We mentioned that in this chapter, and this carries through toward the end of the book in terms of just, you know, maps and navigating spaces and the ways in which, you know, those are networks. Those are networks that we come to take for granted. But I think that part of this chapter, we don't discuss this explicitly, but there's a carry through from the work that you mentioned earlier, Katie, of Lorraine Dastin. In this case, particularly, I'm thinking of Dastin and Peter Galison's book, Objectivity. You know, they end that with you know, looking at going from representation to presentation in the sciences, and the sciences sort of grappling with this space of the arts, the visual presentation of information, and the relation of that to a more objectively rooted in a scientific process. And so that's sort of what I mean, I guess, by thinking of visualization as this sort of fulcrum. And we provide in this chapter ways of helping to bring, I think, you know, Lombardi and Barabasi, for example, together. Isabel Morales, for example, says, you know, we should be thinking about how we use visualization as a continuum between something that's purely descriptive and then something that's argumentative, right? So it gives room and space for us to position through a process, you know, through an empirical process of really getting to understand where are we just simply describing what we see or what we've captured, and then where are we taking our interpretation of that and recognizing that it's not either or, but that it is in fact a continuum. And it's interesting because you mentioned Rosenberg, you know, before, and of course we end the visualization chapter with another quote from him where, you know, he talks about visualization as something that maybe is meant to complicate rather than simplify, that we don't have to assume that this is only about getting us to something that is, you know, diagrammatic, easier to understand, but we can actually very intentionally complicate that in order to, well, I would say, deal with some of the uncertainties, the incompleteness, and so forth, the data that Sebastian was mentioning before.
Yeah, I think exactly. That's a really nice connection back to the discussion about abstraction and how it is not purely about simplification. And I wonder just briefly if you wanted to say something. So, you know, you really go into great depth in the chapter describing two tools for network analysis, Gephi and Palladio. And obviously Palladio is near and dear to your heart. And just thinking about how Palladio operates in the space that you described, right, along this continuum between description and argument, in some of the ways that either it was designed intentionally to enable that, or that you've seen people using it since it's been released.
Mm. Yeah, so you're referring to the fact that we developed Palladio in Humanities Plus Design Lab, which was really, it was a sort of distillation of a number of different tools that were made over the course of working with data visualization and interaction and data analysis for Mapping Republic of Letters. I think we also had a very close relationship with the research behind the research project and Dana Diminescu, who, you know, behind the development of Gephi, and then with the developers who actually built Gephi. And I think it's quite interesting to see, to look at the ways that those two tools developed, right? And how, to go back, you know, sort of to Darker's point, the way in which intention is really encoded into the software itself. And that's why it's so important to use these tools critically and understand where they came from, right? Gephi's, the project underlying that is much more social science project. The there is a sort of assumption that the data sets that you're using are fairly well bounded, or at least if not well bounded, the assumptions, right, about get data as being a given. Given this, this is the kind of analysis we can do. And so one of the things that Gephi does so beautifully is allows you to sort of dynamically see how applying models gives you a result and can help you, help you with analysis, looking at different approaches to applying existing models, right? And that is so much more a social scientific approach than what Palladio is intended to do. Palladio is really intended as a tool to facilitate modeling. Often, within the humanities, there's a sort of resistance to the whole notion of modeling. It sounds like you're, you know, imposing some external idea imposing an external framing. But instead, we wanted to suggest that models are, you know, they're meant to be discursive, they're meant to be broken, but they're extremely helpful. And if for no other reason to, as I had mentioned before, externalize these ideas to make clear in data, for example, you know, where there are gaps, where there are absences, things that are just too easily sort of glossed over in narrative, you know, which is how, you know, most of humanities research is presented, and this, you know, it certainly created a lot. There was a significant backlash. I think the students involved in doing this work, using, for example, Palladio and trying to incorporate it into their research presentations, experienced significant backlash in early days. So it's interesting. It's interesting to think about the, as I said, the way in which we encode methods into tools, encode sort of ways of thinking. It's something that's become clear through this work on networks, precisely because they're so easily adaptable to different contexts. You know, through the Humanities Plus Design Lab, we started with this idea of wanting to externalize thought. Right? It was out of necessity because we needed to be able to collaborate with data science experts, you know, just with computer scientists generally. And it was a way of communicating across these disciplines. Oh, and with designers, of course. But we also wanted to, you know, recognize a responsibility that we had to encode humanistic methods into data-driven research tools, rather than just sort of assuming that somehow whatever exists out there is something that we should just adopt and begin to use, that we needed to take responsibility for actually, you know, bending or building tools to serve our own needs.
Thank you. And I think we have talked a lot about what is in a chapter 5, quantifying culture, but I still want to invite Sebastian to maybe say a few words about that chapter.
Yes, so I think what we touched on before was more about the first part of chapter 5, which is about abstraction of data, network data, and why one needs to choose a particular abstraction for a particular purpose, and what the trade-off is, which is a greater level of abstraction, sort of discards more information temporarily, but leads to a larger number of available analysis methods. But what the chapter 5 also talks about is the, you know, that the varying degree of varying levels of analysis and the varying complexity. And so you can start with simple network measures like degree, which is the number of connections, or slightly more complex measures such as centralities, where you try and gauge the sort of significance of a node in an infrastructural sense by looking at how many shortest paths flow through it. Or but then you can also actually go not just one step further in terms of the sort of complexities I mentioned before, which are sort of directed and weighted and temporal networks, but you can also sort of start customizing analysis in a way that is sort of more difficult to do with off-the-shelf tools like for instance Gephi, which only have standard algorithms. If you can start to frame a historical research question in a quantitative sense, you can design a very custom made analysis that looks for a very specific network pattern involving specific types of individuals, and but you can then search for that pattern across the whole data set, and you can cross-reference also different types of data. So you can look at networks around words, for instance. You can look at all the network links if you've got the metadata on contents, you could look at all the network links that involve the mention of a certain place or name, and so on. So what I'm trying to say is that there's a level, you know, quantitative analysis can become sort of arbitrarily complex, and that's also something we wanted to talk about in this chapter, is that you can sort of reframe. It's not sort of just two different approaches. It's not just about quantitative methods and humanities methods, and it's in some sense there's a, as Scott already said, networks are kind of a bridge, and one of the ways this bridge can be realized is by, you know, framing complex historical research questions in terms of complex custom designed algorithms that you run on these networks and on the associated metadata. So I think that's a bit what we wanted to.
Thank you. And I think another really important contribution of this chapter is to talk about, you know, the practicalities of how we do that, right? How we invite students and early career scholars and really anyone at any stage of their career to work in this kind of collaborative research where, not everyone has to become an expert in statistics and in network analysis tools, especially those that are not, off the shelf, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have any kind of further thoughts about sort of what the first steps are really for someone who wants to embark on this, this pathway of taking up the sort of call to action that this book is.
Yes, I think there's a variety of ways. I mean, you could either I think starting to collaborate is one way forward, but it involves finding the right community. But there's a growing community out there, and then the other way in is I think there's an increasing number of sort of tutorials and resources and workshops and summer schools and programs that start to teach methods, quantitative methods, to people who have no prior experience. And actually we, Ruth and I have been a bit involved in those kinds of programs. And also I know, for instance, at Cambridge, there's the Cambridge Digital Humanities puts on regular teaching workshops for people in the humanities to learn programming and quantitative methods. And I think that's really the best way is to sort of get stuck in yourself, because then you also have the power to shape the analysis, to really make sure that the tools you're using are that you understand them, and then also able to interpret the results, because occasionally with collaboration, the problem can be that if the collaboration is not very close, then the sort of quantitative results end up being quite detached from the sort of underlying historical or literary research questions. So I think the best way really is to seek out these resources and tutorials, workshops, as I mentioned.
And I think I'll say myself, I started learning about network analysis by reading Scott's blog posts. Those are also highly recommended. Thank you so much, everyone. I think in lieu of asking anyone to describe the last chapter, Networking the Divided Kingdom, in a way, I wanted to ask you to respond to the prompt of that chapter, where you talk about how, quote, a well-designed network approach to cultural data reorients us in such a way that the binaries between the sciences and the humanities and arts are eradicated. So I just wanted to give each of you an opportunity to describe how you are doing that now that the book is done.
Seb and I have been working on a project that's a book about how we've applied the study of network analysis to the history of Tudor communication. And so I think that's an example of where we're writing for a literary historical audience. And what it tries to do is sort of move between using very sort of quantitative, large-scale approaches to find general patterns, but then really delves down into really specific case studies to show how it works on the ground and follows like little threads of individual people whose stories have been uncovered through that. And for me, that's a kind of manifestation of how network analysis can be used and the story told in a way that's compelling for our home discipline. But at the same time, we've had to develop new methods to do that kind of work. And we're developing, for example, we're doing work on temporal network analysis at the moment that we're hoping to air in a science venue. So it can speak in two directions. Maybe I'll hand over to Seb there to say a little bit more.
Yes, I think both sides can sort of learn from each other, but also I think it's important that the science and humanities are sort of brought closer together. And I think we sort of talk in that last chapter a bit about the sort of aerial, the analogy of the aerial photograph in archaeology, where you take a photograph of a field and then see some outlines and you go down and dig around. And I think you could even, think about satellite imagery versus aerial imagery and so on. So there's a sliding scale of abstract and concrete analysis that can be done, and I think and I think if one engages in this kind of collaboration, it becomes apparent that really the disciplinary boundaries really are very blurry, and that also that as Ruth was also hinting at, that the sciences can learn an awful lot from the humanities and the way that, for instance, abstraction needs a lot of thought, and the problems and biases in algorithms, that is of course a huge topic at the moment. That is also something which is, I think, much more obvious if you're doing quantitative analysis on humanities data. It is much the flaws in algorithms, and as we also touched on incompleteness. I mean, those issues become much more apparent to scientists as well if they engage in the analysis of humanities data. So, I think everyone sort of benefits from this cross communication, and also in terms of a deeper understanding of their own practice, I think.
That's great. Nicole, do you want to?
Sure. If I could just pick up on what Seb was saying. I've certainly found, this last chapter and using this notion of the local versus the aerial has been extremely helpful for me too, is I think about now being much more in the library. I've moved a bit from being in the research lab to being within the library, and can appreciate much more the degree to which, you know, the library has served the humanities as this, you know, kind of abstracting from sources, you know, doing classification, generalizing in many ways, right, in order to make lots and lots of information more understandable. And I think that particular relationship, as it becomes more fully appreciated in the light of humanities research being engaged much more in quantitative approaches, is going to be very instructive for us going forward, particularly as we think about the kind of work that that Ruth is very involved in now, and you, Katie, with, you know, incorporating machine learning practices, thinking about predictive models and that kind of generalization. How does that relate to the sort of classification that humanities practices have always depended upon within libraries? And not only the classification side of that, but also this other side about bounding data, thinking about curation, collection curation, and what that means, and how much that has actually informed the way that we approach our research questions within the domain. So to answer your question about where it takes us, that's what I'm thinking about very much right now. And this project and this collaboration has been extremely helpful to me in that regard.
I appreciate Nicole for giving the answer that I was going to give as well, so I can speak less. My recent job is also squarely within the libraries, more so than any of my previous ones have been. And in the, quote, Center for Digital Scholarship, rather than the Center for Digital Humanities, the remit is very broad and not just limited to the humanities, which has been, I think, quite freeing. Some of the really most interesting projects we've seen over the last year in the pandemic have, I think, been really fruitful collaborations between technologists and people who are squarely grounded in the humanities. For example, one thing that a lot of people have seen from The Atlantic was the COVID tracking project. And that was definitely a collaboration of journalists, scientists, and humanists really working closely together. And I've been very excited to see here at Notre Dame, there's a lot of those sorts of cross-cutting collaborations. And really, the work that that the four of us did on this book, as well as all of the work that I think we all do on networks, which have been necessarily collaborative across domains, have been really good preparation, at least for me, for my move here, and hopefully for all of us to start worrying less about the disciplines that we find ourselves in.
I think that's an excellent point on which to wrap up this conversation. And I want to thank all of you, Scott, Nicole, Sebastian, and Ruth, for joining me on this interview. The network turn is a really significant contribution. I think, you know, as Scott was just alluding to, not just to kind of people who think about their research in very disciplinary terms, but indeed to kind of beginning to think more about the interactions between those disciplines and the spaces between that have sometimes been forgotten. There's so much opportunity there going forward. And so hopefully we'll see lots of exciting new research there. So thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed speaking to you. We'll see you soon. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.